Perhaps I can describe it as something of a key to the story. Take it as my text this evening in 1 Samuel chapter 15. It is very similar words in the prophecy in verse 23, but also in the explanation that Samuel gives in verse 26. I take the version we have in verse 26. "For you, Samuel said to Saul, you have rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you from being king over Israel." I've realized that it's quite rare for me to take a study on a character. Whether that's a good or a bad thing, I'm not sure. But it hasn't happened very often. But I find that a special interest in doing so this evening, and I trust for a couple more weeks as well. And I hope that it is not simply to look at these men, interesting though they might be, but endeavoring to indeed to learn from them for ourselves and in understanding God's plan and his working it out in Israel. Perhaps by doing what I propose to do, looking at three kings in the next, this week and two to follow, looking at kings will it just help a little in this regard, thinking of them as having a vital role as leaders of God's people. And what they did, we don't see much detail concerning others of God's people at that time, but we do read of these men, and perhaps they can give us some helpful indication concerning man's approach to God, and particularly God's rule in life, being kings. And as we begin to build a picture with these men, they perhaps serve also as examples to shed light on matters of both being influenced, perhaps the emphasis should be different, being influenced and being influential. My examples just for these couple of weeks are three, as I've said. Tonight I would like to spend a little time on Saul, although as I prepared for it I realize, of course, as you might expect, that it is hardly enough, but we'll make an attempt at least. And then followed by David and then Solomon. I think they may well be compared, these men, compared with each other, by virtue of them being the three kings of the United Kingdom of Israel. It would perhaps be unfair to make much of a comparison between any one of them and the kings that followed Solomon in the peculiar difference of the kingdom once it divided. All 12 tribes of Israel were under their rule in succession. But each one of them responded to the task that they had been given in a different way. And each one also left a different legacy within the nation and in Scripture. So we come to Saul tonight. He was the first of the kings of Israel. Until that point, just to remind you, that the nation had been led by judges over a period of roughly 400 years. Judges, in the sense of something like governors, although in many ways we might well say their primary role was in deliverance. They were sent when the nation needed to be delivered from oppressors. And that tale is told in the book of Judges and into the first part of 1 Samuel, because he too, Samuel, was also a judge. He was a leader of the people, one of the great leaders indeed of that period. Over that period of, as I say, roughly 400 years by usual reckoning, it was never a continuous line of leaders, of these prominent or single leaders. There were gaps when everyone was, as the book concludes, everyone was doing what they pleased, doing what was right in their own eyes. maybe in little pockets. There were village leaders or clan leaders, maybe even tribal leaders, but not key people who do appear in that book by name. They were brought forward by God's call, as needs must, we might say. When Israel was in such trouble that the only thing they could think of doing was to cry out to God. Obviously, we know that should have happened first, but they didn't. And it was then, though, that he did send these men and a woman in order to deliver Israel from that oppression. From the time that they became a nation, leaving Egypt under Moses' leadership, until this appointment of Saul, technically at least, although in practice they followed different paths, but technically Israel was a genuine theocracy. It was God who ruled them, we might say, directly. He did it through giving his word through the prophets of the time and the priests. But that changed with Saul. Some have said that Israel was still a theocracy, and insofar as there was still that same system of national and civil law and regulation that had been given to Moses by the Lord, it was still there. What Moses said to Israel in Deuteronomy reminds us of that, that it was to be brought out again each time there was a king. The law had to be written out for him, and he was to hold on to it. It was still the same system. But there was a difference, because there was a king now, if you like, another level of authority. It was the king, certainly, whom the people began to listen to first, rather than God. And so there was a difference to the theocratic system. It was theocratic, but I think we can say it wasn't a real theocracy. And the reason I say that is because that's what Samuel was concerned about, and that's what the Lord himself was speaking about. When Samuel went back in chapter 8 of 1 Samuel, the people came to him and said, "We want a king just like everybody else." And Samuel was upset with them, and he protested, and he came to the Lord and cried out about this. The Lord said to him, "It's not you they're rejecting, it's me." That's why I say, it's not a theocracy in the same way as it once was, or at least should have been, could have been. It was the king that they wanted to listen to instead. That king that they could see and hear and perhaps touch, just like the surrounding nations. Not a God that they couldn't see, although they certainly heard much from him until then. But it was an intrusion now of monarchy into this pattern as well. So it's against that background that Saul, the son of Kish, of the tribe of Benjamin, was made king of Israel. I want to make an attempt at least to outline three aspects, maybe it's six, but I think they tie in well as three. Saul's appointment and achievements, first of all, then Saul's envy and vendetta, and finish with Saul's disobedience and destruction. Saul's appointment and achievements, first of all. Saul was chosen by God. That actually reflects what Moses said to the people in Deuteronomy 17. But for all that, he was still the people's king. You see, he was the king, he was made king on their demand. Yes, God chose the man. God said, "This is the man that you must put in place." But it was in response to their demand. They would not relent on this. As I say, it was told in chapter 8. Samuel, the then leader of the people, warned them of what they could expect from a king. We didn't read this passage. We read Deuteronomy 17, and perhaps you might just recall some of the things that Moses said there. Because Samuel tells them, "You want a king? All right, think about this." And I bring it down a little bit. I'm just bringing out the highlights of it. He says, "This will be the behavior of the king who will reign over you." This is what follows. He will take your sons and appoint them for his own chariots and to be his horsemen. What did Moses say? He will not take for himself horses and chariots. That's being like Egypt. This is what he will do, Samuel said. He will take your daughters to be perfumers, cooks, and bakers. He will take the best of your fields. He will take your male servants and put them to his work, and you will be his servants. And you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves, and the Lord will not hear you in that day. I do believe Samuel knew the law of Moses very well. I'm sure he had that in mind, that passage we read in Deuteronomy 17. But he also had observed the kings of the nations around him. He knew this is what they do. Israel said, we want a king just like the nations. Would he be just like those kings? And so we must make that point first of all. Saul, in one sense we might say, was in the unfortunate position. He was the man who was, if you like, caught in the trap, the demand of the people, but God's resolve that they would have to learn a lesson first, perhaps. They insisted, and God said, I will grant you your request. But remember, with that qualification that he had said to Samuel, they are rejecting me when they demand this. Perhaps it's somewhat puzzling at times why God would do this. Why doesn't he press the point home before appointing the king? But he chooses to do that. We need to recognize that men come to God often with a hard heart. And when man does that, the Lord may grant precisely his request. Doesn't Paul say something like that in Romans chapter 1, that God gave them over to their desires? Only for that to become their greatest hazard. Whether it's a man or, in this case, a nation. God did intend them to have a king in good time. It wasn't for the people to rush it, though. And they did. They wanted it. And they were to learn all that that meant the hard way. They had to learn that what was really happening was that they were rejecting the Lord. And so it comes to the choice of Saul and his appointment and his eventual coronation. Saul, I think, started well. He was not inclined to put himself ahead of others. I really am abbreviating the story, and I trust many of you do know the story. If not, it's there. It's a good story to read. Very readable. But Saul's spirit, it was not pushing himself forward in any way whatsoever. He was very timid, it seems. When they went to look for him, to show him to the nation, this is the man that God chose, they couldn't find him. And eventually it tells us that he was hiding amongst the equipment, which is all the more, if you like, amusing, because when he does appear, he's head and shoulders above the rest. And here's this massive great man cowering down there amongst the equipment. That reflects the kind of man that he was at that stage, very timid. But he was picked out by God and anointed by God. And then you find that God's spirit came on him. There was evidence of that he prophesied, and I think that was for the benefit of the people, that they did know that God had blessed him with God's spirit, at least at the time. But it was essential as well, as you discover in the appointing of all of God's special servants, that the coming of the Spirit of God upon them, enabling them to accomplish their work, to live for him, to serve him, whether as prophets or kings in this case. And so God blessed him with his spirit, prepared him with his appointing, he prepared him for the task ahead. And then, I really am summarizing, Saul did good work for Israel. He faced up to their enemies. He was a focal point that drew men together so that they could fight against the Philistines in particular. He was especially assisted by his brave son Jonathan, who we know later becomes a very good friend of David, Saul's eventual successor. But it tells us, and I am brief because there are not a lot of references to this, but it was a crucial role that he had to play to stand up against those enemies who had been oppressing Israel for so long. And the Lord had stated that this was his purpose for this new king, to deliver God's people from the Philistines, chapter 9 and verse 16. And that's what it tells us in chapter 11, chapter 14, towards the end of that chapter as well. And so just very simply to recognize how Saul's appointment came about, that the Lord was involved in this. The Lord did appoint him. The Lord did bless him. But against a very difficult background, against the background of a rebellious people, hard-hearted people, stubborn people. And then Saul, at least initially, did achieve what he was meant to. But the bulk of the story of Saul is somewhat different. And my second heading is Saul's envy and vendetta. I want to make just reference to it in terms of disobedience, first of all, which I come back to a little later. Because it's very tempting to get mixed up with the two, isn't it? But Saul's disobedience began quite early. It was first recorded in chapter 13. And we would summarize it this evening as arising from fear. He was waiting, and he knew that the Philistine army was coming. He'd been told to wait, and Samuel would come and offer a sacrifice with him and for the people that they might go out under the Lord for battle. But he was getting afraid because he was waiting, and he was waiting. And in the time that he was waiting, the Philistines were coming closer, his own people were getting scared, they were running away, and Saul was looking more and more alone. He was afraid. And it got to the point where he said, I can't wait any longer. Surely the answer to all this is I need to offer this sacrifice, which he duly did. But it was disobedient. And the upshot of that, in that very chapter, several chapters before this even, is that through Samuel the Lord said, I have sought for myself a man after my own heart. That's worth remembering too. It's one of the clearest expressions concerning the next man, who I trust we'll be able to come back to next week. Then you may know the outline of the rest of the story, following on from this. Samuel, because of that, that's the reason I mentioned that at that point, because of that, Samuel was sent, he was very fearful of Saul at the time, he was sent to anoint David to be the next king. Because of that incident of disobedience. You might think, well, it's an incident. Is God not patient? But that's the whole point. This is the king. This is the one who was going to have influence through the whole nation. It was vital that he should be obedient, whatever the test might be. And so the story follows that Samuel went, anointed David to be the next king. That was only about 2 years into Saul's reign. The Lord expressed it to Samuel that he regretted appointing Saul. It is a human expression, I believe, as so often, of what was in the Lord's mind, because it is saying that, really, that Saul was never, in one sense, never the right man, because it wasn't the right time, it wasn't the right thing to happen in Israel. As I said at the beginning, it was the people's king, and it wasn't God's king, because that was not as he chose it to be. But yet, when in responding to them, he chose this man. For that short time, he was the right man, perhaps for a certain reason, but he was not the ideal that God had purposed for his people. I find it myself quite sad, really, to think of this man He was in this role because of the stubbornness of the people. But having said that, we need to recognize that he, Saul, himself, did fail. It was not all the people's fault, if you like, but he failed himself. He was given a task. He was expected to be obedient on that occasion, and he wasn't. He failed because, ultimately, we find that he was filled with the importance of his own position. And that is what penetrates and goes on beyond into the rest of this story. What am I saying about envy and vendetta? Well, remember how David then appears on the scene. He engages in battle with Goliath and wins the victory, although he has stated blatantly at the beginning that it was God who had given him the victory. It was never his to claim, and he never did claim. But the result of it was that when he went back, as the army went back, Philistines just fled, the army went back, and the women came out and they started singing songs, and they compared him, or compared Saul, very unfavorably with David, at least as far as Saul was concerned. And he became envious, especially towards David. And those, I think, generally fairly well-known stories of his efforts to kill David. He eventually deduced, he speaks to Jonathan about it, and he deduced that God, David must be God's choice to follow him as the next king. Already Saul was concerned about that. He was worried that Jonathan wouldn't get the chance, that, as he saw it, was his right. The son of the present king, he had hereditary views already, and that was not part of the plan. That was against. It was him elevating his view, just as Moses warned against. It is a very unhappy episode, there's no doubt about that. It's a very sad state for one who had seen such a fine specimen of a man. But here he is, consumed with a desire to be rid of David. All the time there is still the conflict with the Philistines going on, but it seems like the biggest thing in his thinking is this man, David, who's going to take my throne. It's a very sad thing that he should be so absorbed with that. And he perhaps reigned for something like about 40 years, and a large part of it was given over to trying to catch this young man. In contrast with that, David had a number of opportunities to kill Saul. What does he do? He doesn't, because he says, I cannot touch the Lord's anointed. Yet if Saul knew that David was going to be the next king, he should have known that David too was the Lord's anointed. Yet he was out to kill him. David, by the way, demonstrates, I think, the attitude that the New Testament brings up quite clearly about our views regarding authority, even if that authority doesn't do all in accordance with the revealed will of God. David's view was, I can't harm that man because he is God's anointed. He is put there by God, though he is disobedient and he's taking this nation up all sorts of byways. And so Saul, envy entered his heart and it warped everything. His whole objective, he couldn't carry on the main task that he was intended to do, to deliver the people from their enemies, the Philistines. He didn't complete that task, ultimately to his own destruction. But he carried out that long, long vendetta, as I've called it, pursuing David himself, the Lord's anointed. It's just to reflect the sad condition that Saul himself had entered into. But there is more to it than just that. And I deal with it now under the heading of disobedience, Saul's disobedience and destruction. That was, then, another case of Saul's disobedience. The first, remember, when he impatiently made that sacrifice, having thought that Samuel was failing to keep his word. And then this, his concerted efforts to destroy one that he was aware had been chosen by God to succeed him. And then there's more. And here, in chapter 15 especially, it's a crucial stage in the story of Saul. You see, so we didn't read the whole command, but it does appear in what we did read. Saul had been under orders from the Lord to eliminate every trace of the Amalekites. Absolutely every trace. Elimination. And you might recall the expression he says, and Saul himself says, I have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. That was what was set in front of him to do. He says he did it. Did he? The Amalekites were those who had attacked Israel some hundreds of years before this in the wilderness, when they were especially vulnerable. God had held off what we might call their reward for that. God had promised it would come at the time, but he'd held it off until this time. Now was the time when they were to be, yes, slaughtered. Brutal, yes, but they had stood against God's purposes and in his nation Israel, and that was the penalty for it. But Saul chose a different way. He tells the story himself. I have obeyed the voice of the Lord, verse 20, and gone on the mission on which the Lord sent me, and brought back Agag, king of Amalek. And along with that, he says, I have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. The two don't quite tie in together, do they, in the absolute sense? And then he tells us, tells Samuel, but the people took of the plunder sheep and oxen, the best of the things which should have been utterly destroyed. He knows they should have been utterly destroyed. But he says, the people kept the best to sacrifice to the Lord your God. Do you notice how often he said it that way? The Lord your God. Did he know then that there was a distance already between himself and the Lord? He tells that story. He says, it was the people, the very people he'd been given the task of leading, yet they were taking over, he says. And he allowed them to. I have obeyed. They haven't. Well, he hadn't even done that because he hadn't killed the king as he was supposed to. He then tried to make it sound quite pious with a plan for a sacrifice of the best. Surely that will please God? What could be clearer than God's answer in verse 22 and 23? Has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? To obey is better than sacrifice. Saul's life was already in decline, and this just sped it along. The Lord shows why. Samuel was speaking to Saul, surely under the Lord's direction. In verse 17 of this chapter, when you were little in your own eyes, were you not head of the tribes of Israel? That timidity, that not putting himself forward that we noticed earlier, he was still like that in the early days as he was head of the tribes of Israel. He was little in his own eyes. Did not the Lord anoint you king over Israel? Saul's heart had changed. He was no longer little in his own eyes. That was precisely the problem that Moses was concerned about, precisely the problem that Samuel himself was concerned about, that this is what would happen to this king so that Israel could be like the other nations. This is what all the kings were like, very impressed with themselves. The spirit that I mentioned earlier, who had come on him to enable him to carry that burden of kingship, the spirit then left him. In chapter 16 that follows, in verse 14, it departed from Saul, and in place of it, replaced by a distressing spirit, and perhaps shockingly, from the Lord. He was in decline, and it was going further and further and further. This distressing spirit, again, you might remember the story where he looked for someone to play him or it was recommended, someone to play him some peaceful music, and they found David, a skilled musician. And he was almost speared to the wall several times because of the spirit that was prevailing in Saul. Again, such a desperate decline from a fine man. Then was also that campaign, that vendetta against David. How could a man be pursuing that kind of life and not be in some agony of spirit? But all of these were his own decisions. He does bear responsibility for them. And in all of them, and especially in this one concerning the Amalekites, it was enough for the Lord. The Lord said, "You've rejected me. You haven't stopped to treat my word as it is, the word of the Lord. You've decided you're going to pick and choose various parts of it." And so, even as the people themselves had rejected the Lord before this, before his appointment, so Saul does it. And the consequence is that he then himself is rejected from being king over Israel. And finally, in the heat of losing battle against the Philistines still, yes, they were still strong enough. He hadn't finished the work that he had been appointed specifically to do. And instead of that, Saul takes his own life rather than suffer further humiliation. Saul's life had been very promising, but it ended in that terrible sadness. And David himself was grieved over it at the end. Well, that's attempting to give a very quick outline of the key aspects of the story of Saul. What then do we do with him? And perhaps some of the words that I've used and ways that we do need, I think, to speak of him. It doesn't sound very, very, very good about the man. But the whole point about that is that we do learn from our reading of this story. Our text, as if you like, the last nail, the thing that meant that the Lord would reject him as king, although it is very similar to what has gone before in chapter 13, so that the Lord then looked out for another king to follow. But this text is one that we should learn very well. Very easy to learn. To obey is better than sacrifice. Key, of course, is to apply it. Obedience rather than the finest of gifts. How often we can try and pay our way into the kingdom. Many have done that. Many still will. But it's in harmony with the large lesson of Saul's life, as indicated in verse 17. "When you were little in your own eyes, even then, were you not head of the tribes of Israel? What changed?" Saul got big in his own eyes, being king. Remember when David received that adulation of the women after conquering Goliath and other battles that he went into? Yes, it was foolish of them. It was a very foolish thing for these people to be singing. David himself might have done more to damp down their enthusiasm, perhaps. We might say these things. But they were words, that's all. They also did reflect that God had delivered his people, even Saul's people. They had been delivered from a desperate enemy by this work that, as it happened, David, their champion, had accomplished. Now, if Saul was concerned for the name of the Lord and the name of the Lord through his people, as it happens, remember Goliath was defiant of the Lord himself, being defiant of the people? If the king's concern was for the Lord and for Israel as the Lord's people, then ought he not to have delighted, rather, in the conquest of this new champion who had come on? For the sake of God's people, shouldn't he have been pleased at what has happened? Instead of that, the first thing he picks up is, "It's a bad reflection on myself." He was jealous. Very quickly, he became angry, because his adoring fans had turned their allegiance to someone else, this young upstart. And he realized very quickly that as a result, David could be a serious threat to my throne. But was it my throne? This was the great danger that Israel hadn't considered, that Samuel had considered, that a man would come in and he would begin to regard the throne, the kingship, as his. But it wasn't. It never was. Hasn't, when you were little in your own eyes, did not the Lord anoint you king over Israel? This is why the Lord's judgment on the matter was that Saul had rejected the word of the Lord. In that particular instance, yes. But it's reflective of all that had gone on before. And the result then had to be that he was rejected as the king over Israel. That's a lesson to all of us, that we can very quickly become very impressed with ourselves. But let us look at the Lord himself. Let us look at, well, I keep coming back to this. Maybe it's in the Lord's plan that we do. It's not so long ago. We read in 1 Corinthians, and Paul says those very down-to-earth, modern words, what do you have that you didn't receive? What did Saul have that he didn't receive? But he behaved as though it wasn't his that was just given to him. He behaved as though it was always his. It was his by right. And that is the way that man will naturally go. Excuse me. How much we have to be aware of that. Self-confidence. Is this a long way of getting round to the same thing? Why is the story there? It is there to teach Israel over the generations. It is there to set the scene, and it is part of a bigger picture that I would like to be able to go on to, God willing, next week in looking at David. You see it all the more acutely, I think, in contrast. But that is an essential lesson that we must learn. To obey is better than sacrifice. To remember to be little in our own eyes, that the Lord can use us and work blessing even amongst his own people, not as kings perhaps. But I think there are maybe one or two other little things I could suggest too in our thinking. I spoke earlier about being influenced. Saul himself came under the influence of, if you like, the natural state of man's heart and jealousy that came in so quickly. But perhaps most importantly in his case, look at the influence that he had in the nation, the impact of his agenda, the way he went about his work. Initially it was successful, as I say. I think it's worth a while recognizing that to begin with that he had achievements. But as things went on, the people became ragged. The infighting that followed Saul's death, some immediately snapped up David and said, we want you to be king. But others didn't agree with that. And there was infighting for a number of years that followed. And I think it was a sign of the condition that they had reached. They were not united under one king, under the Lord. And it wasn't all that far removed from the days of the judges, when everyone did as he pleased. And then the king's failure of devotion to God inevitably led to trouble in the land as well. And that's something that we can perhaps bear in mind when we do look at the whole issue of authority, to think about that. We don't have kings, and it's not a covenant people as a nation that we live in, but there are those who are put in places of authority. They are put there by God. Many of them do follow a path that is very self-seeking. Many follow a path that has little regard for God. Perhaps as David we need to learn from, to be subservient to that, even as the apostles teach us. But also to be aware of the impact that that does have within a nation. Saul was ready to be led by the people. The people took of the plunder, so he let them take of the plunder instead of being the king and saying, no, that's not what God said. You kill it. That was not leadership. And we do have a problem, I think, these days, that very often there's other things go on, and sounds and voices, and what should be leadership in the land is going along with it. What do we do? Well, we can reflect on Saul, indeed. We can be aware through Saul. And perhaps awareness is something that we haven't had enough of. Just to realize what an impact, an influence leaders can have. They can have it for good, as I trust we will see. But they can have it for a great deal of evil. But surely also, did the people pray? Samuel, I'm sure, prayed. Samuel was grieved over the things that were happening in Saul's life. The time came when Samuel died. A praying man died. And Saul himself was grieved. Saul was desperate. He didn't know where to turn. Yes, he refused a great deal of Samuel's advice and leadership while he was there. But it was even worse afterwards. We need praying people. We need praying people, aware people. We need to be just such in our own today. But please understand, I don't believe that is the whole picture. And therefore, I would also like to be able to return to two more kings in the next few weeks, God willing. But for tonight, may God bless his word to each one of us.